America's most vocal never-Trumper speaks out against the president as his impeachment trial gets underway. Good Tuesday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for being with us. Hope you had a great three-day weekend out there. Just ahead, as we get back to work, we're going to have a conversation with Florida consultant and best-selling author Rick Wilson about his new book, Running Against the Devil. What are your questions? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, from childhood adversity to adult success, we speak with Leon Baxton, the new CEO of Communities and Schools. That's later on. But first this morning, the stage is set today for the U.S. Senate impeachment trial of President Trump. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has opposed calling any witnesses in this trial, while Democrats are trying to win just enough Republican votes in the Senate to force witness testimony, including that of former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Now, against this backdrop, Republican and conservative critics of the Trump presidency are ramping up their rhetoric as the 2020 election season gets underway. Keep in mind the Iowa caucuses, the first in the nation chance that people have to vote. They're just a couple of weeks out. Perhaps the most prominent never-Trumper around is Florida's own Rick Wilson. The Tallahassee-based consultant and best-selling author is on cable news quite a bit, talking about his concerns about the Trump presidency, and he's also out this week with his second book. In it, he lays out his case for denying Trump a second term. Rick Wilson is on the line now with a look inside that book. It's called Running Against the Devil, A Plot to Save America from Trump and Democrats from Themselves. Rick Wilson, thanks for being back on the show. We appreciate it.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me back.
And what are your questions for Florida's own Rick Wilson, the Tallahassee-based consultant and author, and your thoughts about the impeachment trial of the president and the upcoming election? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. We already have lots of tweets for Rick. We'll get to those in a moment. Our Facebook page is open as well. Okay, Rick, so a couple of years ago, you were on this show talking about your first book. The very subtle title of that book was Everything Trump Touches Dies. That became a bestseller. And so you're out with this new book. Why write another one? Did you feel you hadn't said everything you wanted to say about this presidency with that first book?
Well, the first book was very much a description of the campaign in the first 2 years of the Trump administration. And it left basically a question hanging in the air of how do you beat him? What if you're this powerfully, abusive to the American system of government, isn't it my obligation to try to lay out the knowledge that I've accrued over 30 years in this business of a pathway for Democrats or independents, if we could mustard one, to beat Donald Trump? And so I have applied the skills. The Liam Neeson joke is pretty worn down by now, but I have a particular set of skills, and I'm pretty good at analyzing the lay of the political land and providing strategic counsel in campaigns at various levels. And so I decided I would look at it for my own purposes at first, just wondering, like, how will the Democrats mess this up? How would they blow it? What would I do if I were a Trump, campaign person, and I was trying to defeat them? And so I decided that that was probably a message that would be received by smart Democrats well and by stubborn Democrats with a little resistance. But it's a book of hard truth and tough love. And so far the reception, even from some of my more progressive critics, has been really strong, really well, really gratifyingly strong.
And the message seems to be to Democrats, and to be clear, you are not a Democrat. You've never been one. You're nominally still a Republican, right? But the message,
whatever that party is, I'm a conservative.
You're a conservative, but not a Republican. And I want to ask you more about that in a moment. But your message to Democrats is, you believe that for them to win, they need to make this election a referendum on Donald Trump and stay away from issues that are dear to progressives in the Democratic Party. Why?
Well, first of all, it will be an election about Donald Trump. There's no question about that. It will be a referendum on Donald Trump. Whether they are prosecuting that referendum on Donald Trump, whether they control the narrative about that referendum, is the real operative question. And the fact of the matter is there's no one who is going to be able to win this election based on a health care plan or a climate change plan or a policy paper of any kind. This will be a knife fight to the very last. It will be a brutal, horrifying, no-holds-barred, chains and baseball bat battle with a guy who will go very low, very fast, who will do and say anything. And so it's going to be a very tough race, and they better be ready for that kind of race. And that referendum is the only pathway to getting the voters they need in the limited number of electoral college states to flip back over. It's not going to be based on a health care plan. It's going to be based on, do you want 4 more years of this guy or not? All the election campaigns, whether it's dog catcher or president, are referendums on the incumbent.
It's 549-2937. We'll go to your calls in a moment for Rick Wilson. And this book is called Running Against the Devil. On the cover, you even have devil horns that are sort of drawn on top of President Trump's head. It's funny, but I mean, a serious question. Do you really believe this president is the devil?
Look, I don't believe that Donald Trump is the actual lord of the underworld, but I do believe that Donald Trump is a corrupt and corrupting influence. I do believe that Donald Trump brings out the darkest and worst of behaviors in the people around him and in people that he activates in certain very un-American and dangerous ways. And I do believe that Donald Trump represents a broad and existential threat to this country. This is not a man who I believe has the character to be president of the United States. And I believe, again, that he is both corrupt and corrupting.
You've been consistent from the start about your position on Donald Trump since before the 2016 election. You've spoken out consistently against him. And it's my understanding you've lost a lot of friends and influence within the Republican Party because of this. Do you consider yourself still a Republican at this point?
Well, as we talked about before, there is no Republican Party. There is Donald Trump. And Donald Trump has a party that used to be the Republican Party that he now controls and is obedient to him in every way. And, yes, I lost a lot of friends. I had a very, very profitable business for a very long time, and that's over. I don't do that work anymore. And I miss a lot of the people that I worked with and was friends with for some. Interestingly enough, the people I started with 30 years ago, back in the 1988 campaign time, those people and I have become closer than ever. And the folks who fought in the battles when we were a minority party and were part of the slow, painful climb up to influence and operational ability in Florida and beyond, those people I'm very close to. A lot of the people that really find that what I've done and said about Donald Trump to be very offensive are the younger generation of Republican operatives. And these guys who used to call me and beg for jobs and beg to work on my campaigns are now like, oh, Wilson, he's a liar, rhino, traitor, he's a shill, he's abandoned the party. These kids came in, by the time they came in, they were on third base and thought they'd hit a triple. Born on third base and thought they hit a triple. So it's an interesting contrast of the old Republican Party and the Trump Republican Party sort of played out in real time.
And you certainly don't feel comfortable in the Republican Party of today. You're part of a group called the Lincoln Project. I want to ask you about that as well. That is a group of prominent Republicans and conservatives who are working to defeat President Trump, deny him a second term. What would you say to Republicans out there listening to this who plan to vote for the president? What's your message to them?
Well, look, the message to those folks is that Donald Trump, for all the sugar rush that you're on right now, is laying a set of horrifying predicates of behavior and of horrifying predicates of spending and that the expansion of the power of government and a rule by executive order and a contempt for the rule of law. And this is a future that will turn very dark for you very quickly, either when there's a Democratic president and they feel justified in busting all the norms and the rules, or we stop being a republic as we have known it for 200 and some odd years and find ourselves, you know, in something that looks a lot more like nationalist authoritarianism than an actual American functioning, you know, conservatively drawn, constitutionally bounded republic. And I know that seems dramatic, but this is not a president who has at any point believed in or thought about or considered any kind of conservative ideological underpinnings in his leadership style. It is all about him. It's about his wealth, his ego, his family, and he does not believe that there are any constraints on the power of the executive. And that is a very big deal if you're an actual conservative and not a fake, you know, Trump-style conservative. If you don't believe in the limitations of the power of the state and the power of the executive, then you will discover, as folks around the world have discovered throughout time, that if there is no accountability and power is unlimited in the hands of the leadership, you will soon not have that power be responsive to the citizenship, the citizenry. And that's something I think is a legitimate argument. Now, look, I think that most Republicans, and look, the number of Trump fanatics that's out there, that 30%, those people are not moving, and we're not really talking to them right now. But there is a larger chunk than people think of Republican voters, and they showed up in 2018 and, you know, proved their existence case, primarily in the suburbs, primarily women, primarily educated voters. And those people are reachable, and they are addressable. And we're looking to in this game of very small numbers, influence the course of this election.
And as we watch the election unfold, you know, the Iowa caucuses are a couple of weeks out. But today, of course, the impeachment trial in the Senate gets underway. I want to ask you about that because we're getting lots of tweets for Rick Wilson. Here's one from Rebecca. Does Rick Wilson believe there is any chance that even one Republican in the Senate will vote to acquit or vote to convict, rather, in the Senate impeachment trial? What about the Senate?
Well, hope springs eternal, and pressure is rising. And in one way, they're making a gigantic political gamble, and that political gamble is a bad bet. I'll tell you what it is. They're betting that once the impeachment is over, there will never be another news story about Ukraine. There will never be another fact that emerges. There will never be another associate of Rudy's or Parnas's or Fruman's or anybody else that will come forward with more evidence and additional information. They're making a big bet that the corruption that is inherent in what Trump did in Ukraine will be hidden forever. Now, one thing we know in this world is that corruption is, you know, like a dead fish in the trunk of your car. It never smells better over time. And they're betting that the corruption story will die. It won't die. And who's going to be responsible when it doesn't die? The voters are going to blame them for covering up for Trump. The voters are going to say, you, Susan Collins, you knew what was going on. You refused to even see the evidence or ask the questions or call the witnesses. You, Cory Gardner, knew what was going on.
And let me jump in. Do you think that there's a chance the Republicans could lose the Senate this November if they are seen by the voters as not conducting a real impeachment trial?
I think there are several historical examples that the Democrats would be very, very wise to pay attention to. One of those is 1974, when 49 members of the House went down in flames. Almost all of them were Nixon defenders. 8 members of the Senate went down in flames. Almost all of them were Nixon defenders. In 1994, when Republicans swept the House, it was because, and including knocking out a seated Speaker of the House, the Democratic Speaker of the House, it was because voters were sick of corruption, and they were sick of people defending corruption. And that is a lesson that is enormously powerful. And in 2006, when voters felt like the Republicans were a party that was defending corporate interests over and leaving us mired in a war, they were blown out. So this idea that there's no accountability for Trump may hold. You know, Trump may skate. He may get away with it. He may walk out of the Senate with a pat on the head. But the people that cast those votes and protect him in the Senate will be held accountable by the voters. And that's the bet they're making, is that nothing will ever come to light that will make their decision to join Trump's cover-up and to serve as accessories to him in the Senate. They're betting that nothing will ever come to light. And that's a bad, bad bet.
Let's go to some calls now for Florida political consultant and bestselling author Rick Wilson. It's 549-2937. Susan is in St. Augustine. Hey, Susan, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, go ahead.
Good morning to Rick Wilson. You mentioned that the next election will be a referendum on Donald Trump, and I sincerely hope that is the case. What can we do, though, about the fact that Trump supporters who are, say, evangelicals, will tolerate anything he does because Trump appoints anti-abortion judges, and Trump supporters who are big businesses will tolerate anything he does as long as he continues to deliver tax cuts?
Thanks for that. And, you know, that's a great question, Rick, wherever people stand politically, because even the president himself has said, you know, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and I wouldn't lose a single vote from my base. What about that?
Well, Donald Trump's base actually has fallen apart somewhat. In 2016, 54% of women voters voted for Trump, including 66% of Republican women voters. That number dropped off in 2018 of votes on the ticket. Now, I will say this. Evangelical voters are an inelastic quantity in the Trump equation. They do not really move. He has a very strong lock on evangelical voters. However, evangelical voters, are still people who acknowledge that Donald Trump's moral failings are a front and center issue. And It doesn't make a lot of sense to burn enormous resources with evangelicals, but there is a large movement of religious-oriented voters that are not evangelicals who are moving away from Trump. And you know, if you're an evangelical voter and you believe that Trump is the moral exemplar of our time, I can't help you. You know, there's nothing I can do about that. But you know, we're still going to try to make sure that they don't get a free pass in terms of you know, saying that he's a godly Christian man and then turning around if he's talking about grabbing you-know-what and behaving in ways that are anything but. And where cruelty and inhumanity are a part of his policies and a part of his behaviors, those are going to be contrasted publicly.
It's 549-2937. Ed is in Orange Park right now. Hi, Ed. Good morning. Go ahead, Ed. Okay, Ed, I think you might have put yourself on hold, but what he wanted to ask you, Rick, was why aren't Democrats focusing on the successes of this administration, in particular, the strong economy? And, you know, by his question, I think he meant to say, you know, why shouldn't I vote for Donald Trump again? I like how the economy is going.
Sure. Look, if I go out and get a credit card and run it up with $50,000 on it, I can party all day. You know, it's a great short-term sugar rush. Donald Trump has done three things that the piper will be paid on. The first is we did a $2 trillion tax cut with absolutely zero chance that it was going to in any way drive additional growth in revenues to the point where it was going to be able to, quote, pay for itself. The revenue growth rate that was required was close to 6%. It's just not there. So the $2 trillion bill is coming due on that. The second thing he's done is continued to juice the Federal Reserve to dump money into our economy at a colossal rate, at a truly phenomenal spending rate. And that Federal Reserve zero interest lending is you know, under Obama, Republicans lost their minds over it. Well, he did it for 8 years, and the economy was running very smoothly and very well for 8 years because of that of that gigantic borrowing spree. The growth in the economy is coming from two giant pools of borrowing. Those things are not economically sustainable in the long term, and in the long term, it's going to bite us hard. Now, the gig economy is doing great. The promises he's made to revive the industrial economy are much further behind the curve. But you know, if you borrow a lot of money in the short term and spend a lot of money in the short term, as this administration has done, and you're going to get an economic bump. The other thing is their budgets. We're talking now about a $2 trillion deficit in the last 2 years of the full Trump, the last two budgets. $1 trillion a year deficit. This has ratcheted our national debt into the sky. So, look, if you want to pretend you're doing great, pretend you're rich, go out and spend money like crazy. But eventually, the bank calls. Eventually, they repossess your car. Eventually, they take you.
Let me challenge you on that just for a minute, Rick. I remember vividly during the Bush administration, Vice President Cheney saying, "Hey, deficits don't matter." Why weren't you critical of it at that time? This kind of spending.
Well, I was actually critical of it at that time.
You were?
Because deficits matter. Yeah, I'm a deficit hawk. I actually believe that we need to, operate on a marginal rate, our marginal deficit rate that is somewhere in the 2-4% GDP fraction. And right now, we're riding about 5-6 times that. So you're not talking to a guy who's a deficit friendly. Debt-friendly conservative.
Okay, Lisa's on the line for you from St. Augustine. Go ahead, Lisa.
Good morning. First off, I want to tell Mr. Wilson that he's one of my favorite people that I follow on Twitter because he's erudite, he's witty, and he has an incredible insight into the political process, and I thank him for contributing the ETTD to the zeitgeist. So that's number one. The first question I have is about the Lincoln Project, and a lot of concern was going around on Twitter over the last few days about George Conway's involvement, considering that he is on a fairly extreme conservative point in the spectrum in terms of, I think, heritage or federalist, that kind of a thing, and people are kind of wondering what his real objective is.
And you're talking about the husband of Kellyanne Conway, right? Who's a staffer to the president, George Conway, an attorney who's part of the Lincoln Project, right, Lisa?
Exactly. And a lot, you know, most people are enjoying his, you know, the jabs that he gets as a president, but some of us are kind of more curious about the why.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I get you. And let me kick that over to Rick Wilson. And let me ask you, Rick, do you feel that George Conway has pure motives in his opposition to President Trump, given that his wife is one of President Trump's most vocal defenders? And what about that whole situation?
Look, first off, I'm not going to comment on the internals of the Conway marriage, but I will say this: I've spoken to George at great, enormous length. We've talked about this at enormous length. George is fully committed to the defeat of Donald Trump. He has paid a personal cost and he's paid a professional cost for being in that position. And you know, not everyone is going to have, you know, not everyone who stands up against Trump is going to have the identical set of political priors.
So you think he's sincere? You don't think that he and his wife are gaming this situation out in some way?
Oh God, no. Look, George could have taken the easy path, and all of us have had this conversation with one another. The easy path was always out there for each one of us. At any point, George could have said, "Changed my mind," and the Trump people would have forgiven him. I had a person reach out to me from the Trump world, you know, one of these friend of a friend discussions a week ago, and it was, you know, you could get back in, you could still see your way through, and they'll forgive anybody who changes their mind, we could hook it up, and, you know, I rejected it out of hand, because I'm not a dishonorable scumbag, and So Georgia's motives here are absolutely about the country and the future of the country. And I've known George now for a couple years and talked this through at great length. And I am convinced that George is sincere in his motivations. And this isn't about, you know, there's no second tier set of objectives here. He wants this guy out.
And obviously you do, too. Let me get a few tweets to you. Here's one from Lynn. Is Rick Wilson talking to the DCCC about hiring him? And if not, why not? The Democratic arm of the, or, you know, the campaign arm of the party that theoretically you're directing your message at, your advice.
Well, I'm not talking to the DTRIP at this time. Because I'm working again, we're working on the outside on the Lincoln Project. That's going to be the focus of my campaign stuff right now. The book is full of good advice on how to run and win some of these campaigns. And look, the DTRIP had a great year in 2018. They need to keep that up, even though it's going to be hard to replicate another year that looks like last year. I mean, they picked a lot of the Republican fruit that was out there. The suburban districts that we had won, you know, over years and years of hard work were all squandered because of Donald Trump. So the Democrats are able to pick those up. But the DTRIP needs to keep up the pressure on us. There's probably six or seven Republican members who are vulnerable coming up this year. And again, this book can scale a little bit in terms of how to talk about races that are down ballot and how to communicate effectively with folks who are at the Senate, governor, and elected representative level.
Here's a tweet from Katina. How can we be sure we'll even have a fair 2020 election?
Well, we're going to have a 2020 election that is the most watched, most visible in history. We are going to have to be, as a people, we're going to have to be very diligent and very alert. It should terrify everyone that this administration is stonewalling, and frankly, Mitch McConnell is stonewalling every bill on election defense that means anything. And if they don't,
didn't he let one through though? Wasn't there one measure that went through?
It was a toothless and largely symbolic bill. But anyone who thinks the Russians aren't coming back for an encore performance is out of their mind. They had a great time in 2016. They had an amazing year in 2016. So they will be back to play. They're playing right now on Facebook and social media using the same techniques they honed in 2016. And they're doing it because they know that they got away with it last time. And if you get away with something one time, you're going to try to get away with it again. It's just a fundamental rule of politics.
Here's another tweet for you from Julie. As the former member of a party that deliberately used racism and religion to get your candidates elected for decades, the end result of which is Donald John Trump, do you apologize, she says.
You know, the caricature of the Republican Party as solely using religion and race is historically inaccurate, fundamentally historically inaccurate. And the idea that there's a collective guilt for that is not something I'm going to apologize for because it doesn't exist. I will say, and I do take responsibility in my first book particularly, that a system was built that was less about race and religion and more about a sense of outrage and a sense of aggrievement that we stoked in lower middle class voters in this country. We convinced them that there was a, you know, this is what I call the war on Christmas problem. We convinced them that there's a weaponized set of grievances that liberal elites were trying to destroy them, that we wanted to, you know, burn down their cultural values, that we wanted to erase them from society. We told them that over and over again, that liberals in San Francisco and New York are coming for you. And that was something that, when it was combined with a fundamentally evil and amoral man in Donald Trump, and combined with the decision by Rupert Murdoch and then Roger Ailes before he passed to pick Trump over everyone else, that combination was deadly, and it's caused enormous harm to our society and our culture.
And do you feel bad about that, I think is what she's wondering.
Well, look, tools and technology are agnostic, largely. And the combination of forces that came together, a reality television star who had an enormous cultural presence, a Republican field comprised of uniquely weak men who were unable to fight back and unwilling to fight back, a media infrastructure on all sides that was very much enjoying the spectacle and the ratings that it generated. You know, there were a million things that made it impossible to see another path out of 2016. And you know, what I'm doing now is trying to right the ship. And if there are responsibilities that I have for these things, you know, when I'm personally responsible for something that's an outrage, I own it. But in this case, I'm trying to do this as, you know, and maybe we may be the last few priests of a dying religion, but I'm trying to save the country from this guy.
And let me ask it before I take one more call. It's early, but who do you think the Democratic nominee will be? And who would you prefer it to be, given that I'm assuming you'll vote for whoever the Democrat is this fall?
Well, here's the thing. I'm trying really hard not to pick the Democrats' nominee for them. And I say this a lot in the book. I'm not trying to select the nominee. I have some clear-eyed and objective warnings about what will happen if they choose certain people for the nomination.
In particular, Bernie Sanders? Isn't that what you write?
In particular, Bernie Sanders. If they pick Bernie, if I was still doing this on the other side of this equation, and I was still, you know, hacking away at Democrats who poke their heads up, I would be looking forward to Bernie Sanders like cake on Christmas. I would love it. I would eat it up. This is a guy who will be beaten in 44, 45 states. It will be the worst wipeout since Mondale. They will absolutely destroy him. It will be hideous how bad it is.
But if he's the nominee, will you vote for him anyway?
Look, I don't think Bernie Sanders is going to be the nominee. I think he and Elizabeth Warren have self-destructed. But I do think, prior to the earlier part of your question, I think the nominee will almost, just by historical gravity, be Biden. And he's a candidate who has enough of the populist edge to him that I think Trump is worried about him. Obviously, he's launched an entire phony investigation against Biden in order to try to keep him, or try to hurt him politically. So I think we're going to end up in a situation where it will be a more mainstream Democrat than Bernie Sanders. And I think there are some other rising people out there. I think if you watch how Iowa is going to shape up, you got Biden alone in the field. But you know, the fortunes of, since the Bernie-Warren mutual assured destruction game started, you've seen Klobuchar and Buttigieg rise somewhat in the standings. So they're going to get a ticket out of this thing. But this book is really agnostic to which one it is, you know, other than Sanders. It's really agnostic to which one it is, because the conceptual framework of this book is how to win by not telling everybody your most secret progressive fantasies every day, but how to run a practical campaign and how to do the things that fit in the ideological sweet spot in the 15 or so swing states that will decide the election.
Well, there's a lot more inside the book, and we couldn't get to every single tweet and call, but I know you're doing a book signing in Tallahassee, Rick. Don't think there's one in Jacksonville, unfortunately.
Not yet, but we're adding cities right now, and there's a lot of balancing between the travel and the work I'm doing for the Lincoln and for the book tour. So we are going to try to get over to Jacksonville in the next few weeks, and I will keep you informed as to the details on that.
All right. Thanks for that. He's Rick Wilson, the longtime Republican strategist and best-selling author. His new book is called Running Against the Devil. Thank you, Rick.
You are very welcome. Well, thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And up next, another book to talk about, a look back at the 1920s land boom in Florida a century ago and the lessons it holds for today. That's next.
25 years, WJCT's Radio Reading Service has been providing daily readings of your local paper, the Florida Times-Union. Perhaps you have blindness or need help reading the paper. You can listen to it being read online at wjct.org/radio reading. Or we'll send you a radio tuned to Radio Reading Service. It's free because Radio Reading gives voice to the printed word. Call 904-358-6308.
Welcome back. Well, a century ago, Florida was a very different place. The 1920s, a time of incredible excess, immense wealth, and then horrible collapse. Now, nowhere was the glitz and froth of the roaring 20s more loud and frothy than here in Florida. Think about Las Vegas before there even was a Vegas. Gambling was allowed, so was drinking during Prohibition. It wasn't enforced here. Tycoons, crooks, and celebrities all came down to Florida in droves. Yet the deep impact of the land boom, especially in Florida, has never been explored thoroughly until now. Former Fortune writer Christopher Knowlton takes an in-depth look at that spectacular Florida land boom of the 20s, and he shows how it led directly to the Great Depression, even more so than the collapse of the stock market. I spoke with him about this fascinating new book. It's called Bubble in the Sun. Let's listen. Chris Knowlton, thanks so much for being with us.
Hello, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great. And, you know, as we kick off our own roaring 20s, it's good to take a look back a century, as you did in your book, looking at how the roaring 20s played out here in Florida. This is pretty fascinating. What drew you to this subject matter?
Well, I'm a financial journalist by background, and I've gotten interested in writing about investment frenzies and manias. My last book, which was called Cattle Kingdom, was about the open range cattle era after the Civil War, which is really the cowboy era. And that, I discovered, was one big giant investment boom and mania. And having finished that and looking for a sequel, if you will, I stumbled on the Florida land boom. I knew a little bit about it because I had grandparents on both coasts of Florida when I was growing up. And I'd heard about Addison Meisner, and I'd heard about some of the Roaring 20s stuff that happened in Florida. So I started digging, prospecting, if you will, and lo and behold, there were some fascinating characters. There hadn't really been a definitive history of this land boom written, a couple of slim volumes, but nothing that really gave the full sweep of it, and nothing that gave a flavor for the characters, and I wanted to do something that kind of a narrative nonfiction that gave a flavor for the people as well as for some of the business and economic aspects of it. And I think that may be what's new here and what's original. You know, I've strived to write a very compelling narrative that's both about the human drama as well as the economics.
And Florida is never short on drama. That was true, as you found 100 years ago. You write that the Roaring 20s was excessive everywhere, but nowhere more so than Florida. Why was that?
Well, this was really the greatest land boom in American history. I talk about the vast numbers of people who flooded into the state looking for work, but also to invest in the boom. Everybody wanted a piece of it. It turned out to be, I think, really very significant. It's not just that it was a boom and bust, but I think it had, you know, larger implications for what happened to the economy going into the Great Depression. I talk about how Florida and the bust of the real estate boom was really the dynamite and the detonator for what put us into the Great Depression.
And you're saying it really wasn't the stock market crash of 1929 that kicked off the Depression, that really it was the Florida land boom and bust. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think a lot of people think of kind of equate the Great Depression with the stock market crash of 29, but that isn't really the way it works. There are very relatively few people who actually own stocks. Wealth was very concentrated in the 20s, as it looks to be again today. And, you know, economists, having studied it now, have come to believe that stock market declines really don't normally cause recessions, let alone depressions. Real estate declines, we know now from 2008, the Great Recession, much more serious. Mm-hmm. Deeper declines in the economy, and they last longer. So that really is what happened. There was a land boom across the United States. Florida was the epicenter of it, the sort of spearhead of it, where the frenzy was the hottest. And I think a compelling case can be made, and I think I do the best I can to make it, that this is really an important overlooked aspect of what pushed us into the Great Depression.
And we didn't learn a thing, did we? Nearly a year, a century later, we saw the financial crash of 2008, and nowhere was that worse than here in Florida. And what are your thoughts now as we kick off the 20s? What lessons can we draw from your research into Florida 100 years ago?
Yeah, well, I think the Florida land boom tells us that we've got to be careful about a lot of this stuff. The parallels are uncanny. I mean, Florida's always been a bit of a bellwether, and continues to be a bellwether today, not just politically and environmentally, but, you know, in terms of real estate as well. You know, the real moral of what happened in the 20s is you had, you know, a lot of excessive greed and hubris. There was a lot of similarities with what's going on today. You had great wealth divides. You had two coasts of the state, just like in the country today, who were separated, not just geographically, but economically. Great wealth divides with kind of a rural interior. You had rising nationalism. I mean, a lot of uncanny parallels, which I think should give us pause.
It is certainly eerily familiar, and the themes you raise I think will be of interest to so many readers out there. Now, you're going to be kicking off a book tour appearing on the 21st at Books A Million in Orange Park. That'll be a chance for people to come out and interact with you about the book.
I've got a nice tour set up. I'm looking forward to meeting some readers and chatting with them. We got some great characters here in this book, and I think it's a pretty compelling read. I've tried to make it as immersive and as much of a page-turner as possible, and I think people who give it a try will be pleased.
Thank you so much for joining us. He's author Christopher Knowlton. The book is Bubble in the Sun. Thanks, Chris.
All right, Melissa, thank you very much.
And you can meet Chris tonight, actually, 7 o'clock at Books A Million in Orange Park. Up next, a conversation with the new CEO of Communities in Schools. Don't go away.
ViStar Credit Union, focused on offering its members a safe and financially strong place to save their money and get the loans they need since 1952. ViStar, we never forget that it's your money. Information available at vistarcu.org.
Tchaikovsky himself called it the best thing I ever composed. Pathetique is certainly an appropriate name for the psychological drama that his Sixth Symphony lays bare. The orchestra will be conducted by Anu Tali, who the Herald Tribune praised as charismatic, brilliant, and energetic. Join her and symphony flutist Les Rutkers for this wonderful concert, January 31st and February 1st. Tickets and more at jacksymphony.org.
Work on the 2020 census is about to get underway in Alaska, and for the first time, it'll rely on the internet as the primary means to get us counted, as mandated by the Constitution. Meanwhile, the specter of questions over U.S. citizenship still hover over the 2020 census. The facts from 2020 Census Director Stephen Dillingham. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Democrats say they are defending democracy.
This is about the Constitution of the United States.
Republicans say the case for impeachment is weak.
The Senate must put this right. We must rise to the occasion.
Now senators take on the role of jurors and decide if the president should be removed from office. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Join us for live special coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump from NPR News.
This afternoon at 1 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Hey, what's jazzin'? This is Damian Lamar. Join me for Taste Test and broaden your musical palette as we redefine urban radio. Have a taste tonight from 11 p.m. to midnight here on WJCT 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Well, he overcame many difficult obstacles as a kid to achieve his dreams as an adult. That's why the new CEO of Communities in Schools is perfectly suited to help other struggling kids right here on the First Coast. Leon Baxton joins us now with more about his story and the mission of CIS. Hey, Leon, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you, and congratulations. After 28 years at Communities in Schools, you're now the CEO. Pretty cool.
Yes, and it's exciting. I pinch myself every day knowing it, but it's really an honor to be in this position.
And well-deserved. Now, let's talk a little bit about why you're so perfect for this job. You grew up in Harlem, and you had a tough childhood, right?
Yes, very tough. I had lost my mother to a heroin overdose at 10.
Wow.
Was placed on welfare and moved to the Bronx. And this was the South Bronx with my grandmother, who died on Thanksgiving trying to break up a fight.
Oh,
then
man.
My brother and I were moved back to Harlem, and we lived with an aunt, and we lost an uncle. I lost an uncle who was shot. And then 2 years later, another uncle was shot. Meanwhile, my father had abandoned us and was on alcohol. Died years later, and I still remember being hungry and living in hotels as my aunt moved us around. And it was a challenge. And I saw a lot of violence growing up in my life, in my home, and in my community. And that's when drugs were really prevalent in Harlem back then. But I met a lady named Claudine Howard, who was in an after-school program and took me in and said to me, "What are you going to do with your life, Leon? I understand you've lost all your key parents and people in your life. What are you going to do?" From there, I finished high school at Kennedy and went on to City College and got my degree in sociology.
It was that critical connection with that mentor, which
yes.
is why you are so in tune with this mission of Communities in Schools. They are embedded within more than two dozen Duval County public schools, and you serve 7,000 students. Kids who have real challenges.
Yes, and we're finding that we're working with children that had challenges worse than myself, from hunger to homelessness. And when we talk about homelessness, we're talking about doubling up with grandma in the house and not having adequate space in order for them to learn and connect and read. Violence in the community. We're hearing about the shootings every day. Every time someone gets shot, my first heart goes out to, how does it impact the kids? How are they going to be when they come to school the next day? And that's why it's important with CIS having that caring adult in their life that was in mind to be able to talk them through it as they arrive at school.
You need volunteers, positive adult role models to go in and connect with kids.
Yes, yes. And our staff, the beauty of our staff, what makes us unique, is our staff are embedded in the schools 5 days a week. And they're those caring adults. So when a student misses school, we're doing a home visit, we're calling. When they do come to school, hey, we missed you. It's just being able to listen and being able to care and connect them to certain resources.
And you've got a free after-school program, a literacy program, all of this amazing work is helping DCPS increase its graduation rate. It's at a record high of 85%.
Yes, and we're so excited for Duval County Public Schools and being a part of that. 96% of the seniors that we work with over the years graduated on time. And Duval County has embraced Communities and Schools as a key partner for addressing the whole child.
So with all of that said, you have a huge
excuse me, I Bless try you. Never to sneeze in here, but sometimes it happens. Mm-hmm. You have a really exciting event coming up celebrating 30 years on the First Coast at your anniversary gala. It's called A Toast to the Tassel. That's mm-hmm. the tassel yes. of a graduation cap.
Yes.
It's coming up at the end of this month.
Yes, we're so excited. We're going to have a wine pool. We're going to have a silent auction, cocktails, and then we're going to have a dinner. We're going to celebrate on that day all the years. And can you believe we've served 110,000 students over this past 30 years. And my goal is to serve another 110,000. I'm not sure I'll be there 31 years, but at least put the agency in place so it can serve more kids.
It's CISJAX.org to get your tickets to A Toast to the Tassel. It's coming up Friday, January 31st at the Downtown Hyatt. So, Liam, when you first started at this organization, did you ever think you'd still be there 28 years later?
No, but it's such a reward to be able to see some of the students that I've worked with now who are adults who have their kids in our after school program. And many of them are working for us as full-time employees, even running our after school program. So it's a blessing. I pinch myself all the time when I run into these students, and they're doing well, by the way. Many of them have become police officers, teachers, pharmacists, and just good family members raising their children.
Well, if this sparks your interest, if you want to support communities and schools or even get your child involved, again, go to the website, CISJAX.org. And get your tickets there for A Toast to the Tassel coming up Friday, January 31st. He is CEO Leon Baxton, and it's such a pleasure. Once again, congratulations on being named CEO of this great nonprofit. I can't think of a better person. Thank you so much for all you do.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our show director. Jessica Palumbo is station news director. And our digital editor is Bill Bortsfield. We always value your feedback. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything this morning, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Let's connect then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.